Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's webinar. Sorry for missing last month's webinar, which is going to be when we're talking about today's software root cause analysis. And that was because I had COVID for the umpteenth time, it would appear. And when I get it, like I say to those who ask, I'm actually not close to death, but I do feel like I want to die. So apologies for missing last month's webinar. And now we're catching up what we're supposed to talk about in August. So welcome to a conversation we're about to have regarding software root cause analysis. Now, before I do anything, could I have a show of hands? Who's heard of Anne-Marie Neufelder? Let me have a look at the participants. Who's heard of her? So a few have. All right. So what I'm not going to do is I'm not going to pretend that I know anything more about this than she does. She is all about software. Software for me is software reliability. And if you want to know, if you have a software related issue and you want to really get on top of that problem, or you're concerned about software, you know, reach out to her. I'm certainly familiar with the space, but I don't want to pretend that she is not the patron saint, so to speak, of software reliability. And a ton of what we're going to talk about today stems from the work she and a few others have done. But notwithstanding, when it comes to root cause analysis, even if you think that you're a hardware or mechanical dude or dudette, and therefore you don't need to know about software, you could not be more wrong, especially when it comes to root cause analysis. Because as we know, software runs everything, which means software can ruin everything as well. And so what we're going to be talking about today is just an easy introduction to root cause analysis where your thing could be failing due to hardware and or software issues. So I've seen too many root cause analyses on problems where the people there are hardware people and they only come up with hardware-centric potential root causes of failure. No, that's the craziest thing you ever want to do. Amongst other things, what software allows you that hardware doesn't is the ability to repair from afar. So if you have a product which has software on it and you realize that the firmware has an issue, or even better yet, there's a hardware problem that a firmware update or software update can mitigate, well, you can send that patch over Wi-Fi. You don't need to send a field service team out there to fix a product. So you actually not only want to embrace software as part of your root cause analysis, or at least understanding reliability, you want to prioritize it because often it's some of the easiest things you can fix. So today, in terms of what we're going to be talking about, we're going to be looking at software root cause analysis, or root cause analysis more broadly, where software is a part of it. And we're going to be focusing on the smart lock that many of the veterans to my webinars should be familiar with. I use this as a sort of the baseline example for many discussions. And this is a classic example of a device which has software in it. By definition, it's a smart lock. So we know there's software running things, but it's also at its heart a mechanical product. And so when something goes wrong, it could be due to hardware, mechanical issue, or software could be causing a problem. Now, when it comes to software, we most often think of as a software related root cause of failure, what we call a coding error or bug or defect. And so any of those terms are often used to describe a software reliability related problem where one of these three things are the root cause of that problem: a coding error, bug, or defect. They're all actually all the same thing. We often have three different words to describe the same thing in the world of software, but something's wrong with your code and it's causing something to go wrong. So let's just say we have a problem with our product. We have a system fault or failure. Now, for those of you joining, you would have read that in the brackets part of the webinar's title for today, there was fault trees mentioned. So I'm going to be using and referencing fault trees a lot during today's conversation. I'm not going to explain them in too great a detail. So there's a bit of assumed knowledge we can only cover so much in each webinar, and I have plenty of other webinars which deal with fault trees as well if you need to brush up on what they are. But at the top of each fault tree is what we call a top event, which is within this shape here, which is sort of like a rectangle with rounded ends. And at most root cause analyses have some variation, at least in the space of reliability, have some variation on these words on the right of the screen as we were looking. And so in the fault tree, which is used to do root cause analysis, we have at the bottom of our potential fault tree, these circles or sometimes ellipses, which represent potential root causes of failure. And the fault tree is all about trying to come up with all these all these different ways of understanding how things can fail. And so if we have a look now, when my computer decides to catch up, at our smart lock in greater detail, we're going to say, we have come across some issue with our smart lock. And in this case, the issue we find with our smart lock is that it doesn't lock when commanded. So a smart lock is not just a lock activated by a key or controlled by a key anymore. It is something that we have the ability to control from afar. And so when we talk about commands, we're talking about some remote instruction to our smart lock to lock. And let's just say, for whatever reason, a user has a smart lock or running a demonstration test in-house, and our smart lock doesn't lock when commanded. So remember what I said at the start of this conversation, where you just simply cannot conduct root cause analyses on products like this without thinking about software as well, because we know that if our lock's not locking when it's commanded, it could be down to a hardware issue, or it could be down to a software issue, or a combination of both. And what do we do a lot of the time when we are doing root cause analysis and we only have hardware people in the room? We pretend software works perfectly, or just have one big box representing software and don't busily explore it. You can't do that. If you're serious about root cause analysis, you need to be fluent in both the hardware and software causal chains. That is, we need to understand how hardware can cause failure. We also need to understand how software can cause failure. And this is very intimidating to hardware engineers in particular, but don't worry, it's not nearly as bad as you might think. So if we start doing root cause analysis with our fault tree, we might start brainstorming down one level. The facilitator might say, you know what, just to make sure we're on the same page, we're going to have two intermediate events, one called hardware, one called software. And this is a great idea to force our root cause analysis brainstorm, which is what a root cause analysis starts with, to focus on hardware potential root causes of failure and software potential root causes of failure. And so, for example, we might, when we do root cause analysis, we might do some brainstorming and realize, you know what, the smart lock might have a solder joint fracture. And this blue shape here, it's called a link event. That means that with this sort of, it's got a square bottom with a triangle on top. That tells us straight away that there is some model that we've done somewhere, some fault tree that already exists that describes solder joint fracture. So we don't want to re-brainstorm the wheel, so to speak. And so we just have this shape here, which is one explanation. And that fault tree, which describes or does root cause analysis and solder joint fracture, has a ton of potential root causes already brainstormed. And we, to save time, we're not going to redo that. And of course, you need to know as a facilitator what has already been done in terms of root cause analysis on your device or your product or your system, because you don't want to do things twice. You want to be very as efficient as possible. And let's just say, of course, there's a lot more to hardware sort of hardware failures than that, but just to give you a taste of the sort of things you might be looking when you do the hardware stuff before you move on to software. So let's just say we brainstormed, done root cause analysis for hardware, and I know I'm sort of not rushing through, but I'm really truncating the hardware piece. The main takeaway is that you need to have a fault tree or a fishbone diagram or an Ishikawa diagram, which deals with both But now we, once we've done hardware, now we can move on to software, and we focus on brainstorming the software potential root causes of failure. Now, in the world of software, we need to make sure that we understand how the software is going to be used. So in a smart lock, we know that a user can command our smart lock to lock through the app on a smartphone. The user can also log on to their online portal and log, essentially ask the lock to, again, lock from afar. So these are two ways that a command can be initiated. A third way is for smart locks with Bluetooth proximity capability. When the smart lock detects that the user is coming home, in this case, holding a child and groceries and walking the dog at the same time, the idea is that the front door is able to automatically unlock when a Bluetooth signal detects the smartphone of our user approaching. So this is another way that our smart lock can be commanded to lock. And yet another way is when someone enters the PIN on the front, or I should say the PIN into the keypad on the front of the smart lock. And yet another way is when there is a smart device in the house where the user issues a verbal command to lock the front door or something similar. So we have one more as well, when we have the good old user using a key. And now that may or may not require a software response, but the very first thing when it comes to software is understanding how the software is going to interact with the world around it. Now, some software programs, they exist within a system. That is, they only have hardware inputs or sensor inputs. They don't interact with the user, but a good chunk of software, like the software associated with smart locks, interacts with human beings, and therefore we need to understand how our software can interact with the world around it. And so you need to get on top of your use case really, really thoroughly. And so what we do now is brainstorm one layer at a time. And when I facilitate a root cause analysis, I make sure one of the very first things we do is go through the use cases, go through the users, the way our thing is going to be used. And I don't mean reviewing line by line in a spreadsheet the different temperatures and, you know, how things can be commanded. I always create typically three avatars, three characters, three personas, whatever you want to call them, where we talk about how person A is going to use a smart lock in a certain way in a domestic setting. Person B is going to use a smart lock in a different way, perhaps on a professional site to control access and egress from sheds and garages on a rail site or something like that. And person three might be an older gentleman with mobility issues who has a smart lock on the door to his apartment or room in an aged care assisted living facility. And so I also use AI to create images of these people to try and help the brainstorming team, the root cause analysis team, build empathy with the customer and user and really think about how the smart lock's going to be used. And when we do brainstorm, we go down one layer at a time, looking at our smart lock from the perspective of each one of those users. And then the next thing we do when we go down the first layer of brainstorming is we try to come up or try to think of potential software failure modes that might result in our smart lock not locking when commanded. Now, the textbook boring definition of a software failure mode is it's the functional consequence or consequences of a coding error, software defect, or bug, which means the software is doing something it's not supposed to do, or the software is not doing something it is supposed to do because we have some issue with the actual code itself. Now, when we go down to software failure modes, it's actually very useful to break them down into categories from a brainstorming perspective. And the reason being is that lots of software engineers out there, software reliability engineers out there, have already done a lot of research into the typical ways software ruins your day. And there are categories of software failure modes out there. And if you think about software failure modes, if you brainstorm software failure modes, focusing on one category at a time, it's a really good way of making sure you don't miss anything. So for example, software fire mode category number one, faulty state management. So this of itself is not a software failure mode, but this is a category of software failure modes where which could potentially result in our smart lock not locking when commanded. So in this case, what we talk about faulty state, when we talk about faulty state management in software, it usually means something like this, where the smart lock believes the software on the smart lock believes it is already locked when it is in fact unlocked. Now, if that's the case, that means whenever it receives a command from a user to lock, it will go, no, we don't need to. It is already locked, even though it is unlocked. And hopefully this simple definition of a software failure mode category is going to get your creative juices flowing when it comes to software root cause analysis. I dare say many of you could start thinking about the reasons why the software on the smart lock might accidentally think it's already locked when it is in fact not. So that's faulty state management, which is one of many software failure mode categories. And so if I'm facilitating software RCA, I want to make sure that I have a plan, and I will start by going through these software failure mode categories. And there's a lot more pre-existing ideas about what software failure modes exist as well. And so faulty state management, this could mean that the states are stuck, i.e. there are no transitions when conditions for a transition are made. So this is a software failure mode where the states are stuck. The software doesn't allow the lock to change from one state to another. That's a software failure mode. And straight away, if we start thinking that this is a plausible explanation of what's going on, the software engineers would straight away be able to look at the software code and essentially see if this is an issue or not. And hopefully can start to see how this helps the investigation process. Another potential software failure mode that falls within the category of faulty state management is that the software as a whole is missing a state or state transition. Now, this is probably unlikely for a smart lock, which has essentially two states, locked and unlocked. It's be highly unusual for the software team to even contemplate not having a locked state. But this happens a lot for more complex software systems, especially if you think about a spacecraft, for example, where they are in multiple, lots of different states as they land on a planet far, far away. And so sometimes some spacecraft have, the software has skipped the step of landing, being in the landing mode to disastrous consequences. So that's another potential software failure mode for a smart lock, perhaps. Not likely, but it's another example of faulty state management. And essentially, it means we forgot to code the lock to lock. That's what it means. And so now we're starting to think about how our smart lock might not be working. Another one is the software is unstable after an unexpected loss of power or after an unexpected user abort while in a particular state. This is a little bit wordy, I know, but this is a big one. And here's why. Think about the software assumes the lock being locked when power is returned or software is or restart is complete. That is, the code might be written where, for whatever reason, when we're initializing the variables, it starts with smart lock is locked, regardless of what state the lock is in. And this happens, this could be a kind of an issue if you forget about it, because every time the batteries go flat and you replace the batteries, it means that if you have this software failure mode as part of your code, means that regardless of you changing the batteries or not, the software regardless of what state the lock is in when you change the batteries, as soon as you put new batteries in, if this software has this vulnerability, doesn't matter if the lock is locked or unlocked, the software automatically assumes lock is in a locked state from the very start. And this happens a lot if for software, you think about not just batteries being depleted, but whenever there's a power outage in a manufacturing facility, when everything comes back online, what's the software expected to do when there's a power outage or there's a power, even if a brief spike, which causes everything to shut down for a couple of seconds? What is the software supposed to do for the arm that controls that plasma cutter cutting your $100,000 piece of steel? So this is a very applicable one for not only smart locks, but lots of different systems which combine hardware and software. And so hopefully you can start to see that by thinking about specific categories, we now come up with lots of really cool ideas. Another one is software is missing a fault or a safe state. That is when something goes wrong, the software doesn't have essentially a plan B. What happens when the software can't tell if it's locked or not? If there's nothing planned for the software to do, then the software can potentially essentially have kittens. Another one is missing a transition to a fault or safe state. So maybe you have thought about it, having that fault or safe state coded into your software where a warning gets sent to your smartphone, but you've forgotten to put in the code to trigger a transition to that state when it should. Another one is whether behavior, the fault or safe state is inappropriate for the mission, which is a very military-centric definition, but there's a reason why we're using these definitions, and we'll come to it in a minute. And another one is the software executed a prohibited transition to another program, or software accepted a prohibited transition from another program. What does that mean? An example could be that software unlocks every time it tries to lock. That happens routinely in many sort of early versions of software being coded. And so here are lots of different ways. So another one, software allows the system to be in more than one state at a time. That is, you might have some multiple variables without realizing it, especially if you have multiple people working on the same code, where variable X is used by one person to define if the lock is locked or not, and variable Y is used by the other person, and all of a sudden you might have a scenario where X equals one, but Y equals zero. So depending on which variable the program uses to assess if the lock is locked, it might get the wrong idea about what's going on. So that's a scenario where the software allows the system to be in more than one state at a time. So here are 8 failure modes that fall within the faulty state management software failure mode category. And just by thinking about these typical failure modes, I dare say if you knew what these 8 generic software failure modes were, or actually had this list, even if that's the only thing you learned from today, if you had to conduct software root cause analysis, or at least root cause analysis on a product which includes software, straight away, you've got some ideas to ask your RCA team to brainstorm about regarding the reason why your product isn't doing what it's supposed to do. So 8 failure modes, or generic or pre-existing failure modes that for the software faulty state management. Now, I'm not pulling these from thin air. In fact, there's an Excel spreadsheet which has these 8 typical software failure modes that fall within the remit of faulty state management. And this Excel spreadsheet is available to anyone, who logs on to the right web page at the Defense Acquisition University. And you'll get the link to that to this spreadsheet at the end of this webinar. Or if you want to simply Google it, Google this thing called Common Defect Enumeration, because that's the title of this spreadsheet. This spreadsheet contains software failure mode categories like faulty state management, all the generic or observed types of software failure modes for that category. And better yet, it comes up with lots of potential root causes of failure, how to detect them, especially doing a software failure. And so a lot of potential ideas for why your thing is failing is contained within this spreadsheet. And like I said, the first thing we looked at is faulty state management. That's right at the very top. Now, that doesn't mean that this spreadsheet is going to tell you what's wrong with your system, because you still need to take these software failure modes contained within the spreadsheet and apply them to your system. So for example, that software failure mode, which deals with essentially your smart lock losing power or restarting, well, what does that mean? Well, that means the batteries have run flat and you change the battery. So don't just copy that phrase or that copy that software failure mode verbatim. You need to then turn those words into words that matter for your product. And a good number of the failure modes in this Defense Acquisition University Common Defect Enumeration will not apply to your product. So you need to work out which ones don't apply as potential reasons why something's going wrong. Ignore them. And the ones that do apply, you need to reword or rephrase or recontextualize to make sense to how your thing's supposed to work. So another software failure mode category is error handling. Another one is timing. Another one is functionality. Another one is data definition. Another one is processing. And you can see here, we have lots of different software failure mode categories. You can see we also have at the top right-hand corner, we have software failure mode category that relates to machine learning. So of course, if your product doesn't do any sort of machine learning, you can immediately ignore that category of software failure modes. So this spreadsheet is an amazing resource for people who want to understand what's going wrong with their product or system. So machine learning, like I said, unless your product has got machine learning, you can immediately exclude this category of software failure modes. And our smart lock, indeed, as you could probably surmise, does not use machine learning, so we don't need to go to that part of the spreadsheet. I can see that Fred has actually put the link into the chat as well, if you want to be aware of that. So what we do is we go down one layer at a time when we're trying to understand why our smart lock isn't locking. We started with faulty state management, and we obviously, once we got faulty state management, we can then move on to other categories. But as a rule, what you want to do is get the software failure modes that relate to that software failure mode category before you move on. So we're going to reword, faulty state management to make sense to your product. So here I've reworded believes it is already locked when it is unlocked. So that is essentially rewording faulty state management to words that make sense to our product. And that's a fantastic thing to do, not only for your brainstorming team who help you with this fault tree, but for anybody else in your organization who's going to read your fault tree in the future to try and perhaps deal with their issues as they observe them. It's one thing writing faulty state management, which doesn't mean much to many people, but if you say it believes it is already locked when it is unlocked, don't care who you are, you have a much better understanding of what you're talking about when it comes to that issue. So the software is unstable after an unexpected loss of power or after an unexpected user abort while in a particular state. That's the word for word quote of the software failure mode from the CDE, Common Defect Enumeration. Let's reword that to words that make sense for our smart lock. The software assumes the lock is locked after batteries are replaced. So you can start to see we're not copying and pasting directly from that spreadsheet. We're using those words to come up with events that make sense. And here are here is a fault tree element that has different software failure modes, brainstorm for our smart lock, and I've taken the liberty of changing the words of the three that are shaded in red, just to give you an idea of how you go about imbibing the common defect enumeration into your root cause analysis. So let's just say that we now, as part of our, we got this reworded event from our common defect enumeration. We are not obviously done because this is a software failure mode. It's not a potential root cause of failure, which means we aren't able to deal with it yet. We aren't able to rectify it. So the CDE, the Common Defect Enumeration, then breaks down the potential root causes into those that are embedded in specifications, where the specifications in this case fail to identify what to do after the batteries run flat. classic issue when it comes to software failures, where the specifications don't tell the software engineers what they're supposed to do. Another one is that specifications aren't tailored to deal with different states after batteries run flat. That is, the software isn't, even though it's specified, it doesn't do a good job of explaining to the software engineers that, hey, there's a potential of this smart lock to be locked, unlocked, or somewhere in between. And you can see that because I've shaded these red, these are reworded versions of the text from the CDE. And then there are other potential root causes outside of specifications where essentially it means that the specifications are fine, but the code doesn't implement requirements dealing with batteries running flat. That is, our software engineers were told to do something, but didn't. Now, this is really important or useful information because now you can go away and see if the specifications were indeed the problem. And if not, then you start to look at the code. And it doesn't take long to realize or work out if the code is a problem for batteries being changed. So now we have a really powerful element of our fault tree to help us quickly debug or quickly investigate and rule out potential reasons why our smart lock is failing. And it comes from common defect enumeration. I can't stress enough how valuable this is, but even though it's very, very valuable, you need to tailor the words to words that make sense for your product, for your system. And it also can't cover everything. So just because we have a ton of really useful guidance in the CDE doesn't mean you stop thinking once you've run out of ideas. So when I brainstorm, when I finished going through the faulty state management software failure modes in the CDE, I always ask the team, is there anything else that the CDE hasn't covered yet? Because your product is unique by definition. So if we go back to the batteries running out, for example, what other reasons could the batteries running out, or what is the essentially at the heart of what could cause our smart lock to not lock when our batteries run out? It's not just the coding issues. Let's just say it's not just software. When batteries run out, how does the software know what state the lock is in when things get powered up again? And to do that, let's look at the concept of volatile versus non-volatile memory. And these are these definitions use the word volatile. You'd argue that's overly expressive when it comes to defining these things. And that's probably because we now use the word volatile in everyday speak to describe, you know, angry people who go off in a heartbeat. We're not interested in using that term here because the term volatile essentially comes from chemistry and physics, where it describes things that are stable versus unstable. So volatile memory, what is volatile versus non-volatile memory? And most devices have a healthy combination of both. Now, volatile memory, if the smart lock state is stored in volatile memory, the problem with that is that volatile memory has a key weakness. And that is volatile memory, when the power is removed, the volatile memory resets. Non-volatile memory, on the other hand, doesn't. So if the lock state is not stored in non-volatile memory, it means that every time we lose power, the software will not be able to work out what the state of the lock is. If, however, the lock state is stored in non-volatile memory, which is memory which doesn't matter if the power is cut or not, when the power comes back on, it will still remember that variable's value. Well, that means the software can check the non-volatile memory, see what state the lock is in, and therefore, when the power's back up again, it knows exactly if our smart lock is locked or otherwise. And so here's an example of a potential root cause of failure outside the scope of the CDE. Now, as an aside, why might people ask, why don't we just store everything in non-volatile memory? Well, non-volatile memory is bigger, heavier, more expensive, and slower. So volatile memory, which requires constant power to remember everything, is faster, smaller, and everything else. But unfortunately, when the power cuts out, it forgets everything. So it's always a trade-off. You could argue that one thing you cannot trade off is a variable as important as the lock state being stored in non-volatile memory. Or another potential root cause is the absence of a lock state sensor, which means we don't have a sensor, some sort of probe or what have you, that's able to detect if the bolt of the lock is fully extended or otherwise. So both of the corrective actions for these particular potential root causes are store current state variable in non-volatile memory, or if it's early enough in design to incorporate some sort of sensor to physically measure how far out the bolt is to understand what state it's in. Or you could have some sort of reinitialization on startup where the motor tries to extend the bolt as far out as it can, no matter what happens. So it's 100% certain of the state of the smart lock when the power comes back. So that's just part of the root cause analysis when it comes to understanding the software or how software could contribute to our smart lock failing. Now, when it comes to specifications, there are issues with specifications that themselves can be categorized. And for example, if we first look at the specifications in terms of our fault tree, our root cause analysis, that's usually the first thing we need to do. If the specifications are missing requirements, that means we found the problem. However, if the specifications are fine, then we have a problem with the code or the system. Now, as a rule, if you have a problem with your specifications and requirements, that's way more expensive and problematic to solve than coding errors that forgot to implement the specifications or requirements. So there's a problem with the code or the system. And what we want to do now is when we're doing fault tree analysis or we're doing RCA is make sure that we don't interrupt momentum. So what we want to have is that fault tree with all these different potential root causes, but we can't pause their brainstorm every 5 seconds to have someone go off and see if the specifications are indeed fine or otherwise. We just put them on our fault tree, and it means that when we start analyzing that fault tree thereafter as part of RCA, first thing we're going to do for specific failure modes is to look at the specifications first to rule them out or confirm that they're an issue and before we move on. But because we can't keep interrupting root cause analysis, we need to include both. And that's where the facilitator, this person here, comes into play. And this person here, this character I use a lot to represent an amazing reliability engineering facilitator. She or whoever your facilitator is needs to be on top of this stuff. Now, that said, if there is scope for a judgment call to be made, so perhaps someone can really quickly rule out specifications. Someone can very quickly look up specifications during RCA, or perhaps you have a scribe who's doing that real time, then of course you can rule out specifications and remove that part of your fault tree for your root cause analysis. So it's up to the facilitator to work out what is going to be too much of a momentum drag and what's going to be what's going to help sort of simplify the fault tree that you come up with. All right, so now you're starting to see, hopefully, the power of the common defect enumeration. Now let's look at another software failure mode from the CDE. The software allows the system to be in more than one state at a time. Well, what does that mean? Well, obviously, the bolts can only be extended or retracted. So physically, there can only be one state, but this is not talking about what's physically going on. It's talking about what the software thinks is going on. And as a rule, we usually have what's called a state variable. And the state variable is defined by either a zero or a one or a truth variable. So in this case, the software engineering team might say, well, whatever the state variable is, we define it as being equal to zero when the lock is unlocked and being equal to one when the lock is locked. And that state variable was going to be called or labeled something like current state. So the current state variable can either be zero or one. Hopefully you're with me so far. And so what that might mean is that if there's a problem in your product, it means that for some scenarios, your current state variable can be set to zero, even though the physical state of the system, as you can see on the right, means it should be set to one. So that's obviously a problem. There's something going wrong. And another scenario that's going wrong is where the lock is physically unlocked, but the current state variable believes it or is acting as if it is locked. So that is a scenario where the current state variable is equal to one, even though the lock is unlocked, the bolt is fully retracted. And so one reason why the software might be confused like this is, again, the absence of a lock state sensor. That is, we don't have a physical sensor within the smart lock itself to be able to measure how far out the bolt is to determine physically if it's locked or otherwise. And so this is another potential root cause of that problem. Now, just to be clear, what we're not trying to do in our root cause analysis is make judgments about what is feasible and what's not. We want to facilitate brainstorming. So there might be some people who say, hey, a smart lock sensor, that's way too expensive, or we're way too developed. We're too far down the production schedule to change the hardware design that much. And we go, that you need to acknowledge that that could be the truth. But in root cause analysis, we will let somebody else make that determination. But right now, we don't want to have any preconceived limitations of what is feasible or not. And so as a facilitator, you want to encourage people to have, for example, potential root causes of failure being the absence of a lock state sensor, even if some of us believe that it's too late or not economically feasible to have one. So this is the second time that particular potential root cause has been observed. Another potential root cause, and this is a reworded version of a potential root cause in the CDE, is there's a coding error where the current state variable is not updated. That's a very simple one, and usually that's pretty easy to fix. And now you can start to see that if we were to keep brainstorming through these different within this single software failure mode category where the lock is already locked when it's unlocked, you can see that we have a bunch of potential root causes of failure within our software code itself. And now we have some useful things to track down, to investigate, to see if software is indeed the problem. Now it's giving us a lot of really useful information. Here's another category of software failure modes: faulty error handling. And this often comes from hardware design issues, or it could be caused by a software coding error, which is something that's consistently going to explain lots of different things. But when we're talking about faulty error handling, here is another reason why you cannot do software root cause analysis without having hardware guys and girls in the room. Because if the smart lock is in a physical error state, then the software team needs to know what those physical error states could be and what that means and how the software is going to detect it. So you simply cannot do this without having hardware people in check. And one of the ways that you can often get error states is when the users do something that you don't think they should do. You know, it's all well and good to say, well, they shouldn't do that, so it's their fault. Well, that's just not the case in the real world, because if they're trying to make money, or if they need to have the front door of their home secure before they go on holiday, they're not going to wait the 2 to 3 weeks it's going to take for your customer service to get back to them to fix the problem. They need to fix that problem as soon as possible in their eyes. So they're going to do things like this, where they try and fix things or use your device in different ways. And so if we go back to the CDE, there is another software failure mode where hardware faults are not detected or properly handled. And so without having to put too much effort into planning, you can use a CDE to come up with lots of really useful ideas about why your thing is failing. So let's have a look at how that works in the real world for our smart lock. So here is the electric motor for our smart lock. And one of the ways our electric motor can go into an error or faulty state is the insulation on the cabling that creates the magnetic field within the motor. The insulation on that cabling starting to break down. So essentially the current doesn't go all the way through the wire anymore. It has a short circuit to an adjacent one. And all of a sudden we have a lot more power going through the through the motor with a lot less rotational velocity and torque coming out. And the insulation will break down over time. All of the electric motors will eventually fail due to this. Now let's just say that's what's happening for our smart lock. We have a problem if that's what's happening. Now, here's a good example of why hardware and software teams should be joined at the hip, because this is going to happen. It's going to happen. It's a hardware issue. Whether it happens within the life of your smart lock is a different question, but this is where software engineers can solve hardware problems. So the insulation will break down eventually. Let's not pretend it's not going to. So what can we do? Well, here is what we call a switching system. And the switching system might seem like a bit of a jump, but for those who've attended my previous webinars, where I've dealt with fault trees, the switching system is where we introduce the idea of what we call priority and switching. So this is a little bit of revision, I know, but the idea is that we have a pump station where we have a primary pump, and when it fails, it's supposed to trigger a valve to then move to the backup or redundant pump. And you can see we have a priority AND or PN gate in the fault tree, which models our switching system failure. Long story short, it means that if the switching valve fails after the first pump fails, well, that means it's still been able to switch when the first pump fails. Hooray, things work. However, if the switching valve fails before the first pump fails, then essentially the backup or redundant pump can't be used, and therefore we lose the value of redundancy. And so the priority AND gate is a way of explaining how things happen in sequence. And like I said, I do other webinars on fault tree analysis, so I'm not going to go into fault trees and the logic gates in too much detail. For hopefully those who need to can Google what a priority AND gate is. But we use priority AND gates a lot in software because software often depends a lot on the sequencing of things. And so usually we have a software fault causing that switching valve to not work. So when it comes to, when it comes back to our smart lock, we now have an issue with our, as discussed, we now have an issue with the wire or the cabling that's creating that magnetic field. And so what can we do? Well, one way of detecting it has a problem, our smart lock has a problem, or this motor specifically has a problem, is we can measure how much current, how much voltage we supply to it. And if we know how much, how little torque is remaining, well, one way of mitigating this problem is by having the software automatically increase the amount of voltage that's provided to the smart, to the motor. So long story short, as the insulation degrades, becomes less efficient, the software can automatically then provide more voltage to then mitigate or extend the life of our smart lock. And of course, the trade-off will be that that will drain batteries faster, but I guarantee you 9 times out of 10, that's a trade-off we will take any day of the week, where our products are still working fine, they're just going through more electricity compared to a similar product which doesn't have that software feature, which means that, yeah, they don't go through the batteries as quickly, but it doesn't work anymore. So this is how software can deal with hardware faults and issues when it comes to most ways our things fail. And in many cases, we lose lots of opportunities for software to essentially extend the life of products by adjusting things like that. So here are, in this case, here are the six different ways our people can interact with our smart lock, because we're not done doing root cause analysis just yet. We've talked about faulty state management. We talked about how hardware faults need to be detected and dealt with accordingly. So let's go back to our six different ways a command can be sent to our smart lock, because we're going to talk about something else that can go wrong when it comes to our smart lock. So for example, let's just say we have a user walking past a smart device in a home who's telling somebody else, "Hey, Sherlock, can you please mop the floor?" Well, our Alexa or Google or Siri hears that and believes that the words that came out of that person's mouth were, "Please lock the door," which sounds similar. And so all of a sudden, we now have a scenario where our smart lock is doing something that it's not supposed to do because it misheard the users. Now, this might sound like something we don't need to deal with when it comes to hardware and reliability and software reliability, but we absolutely need to. And one of the easiest ways to deal with this sort of problem is to, for example, have a feature where the smart device in the home will automatically recite back to the user what it believes it heard, so the user can then do something about it. The number of times things have been accidentally asked to do something without the user knowing or being aware of it being asked is astounding. Here's another problem. Let's just say we have two users who are sending or communicating with the smart lock at roughly the same time. So one's using a smartphone, the other one's using a computer. And they might be sending exactly the same command. Now, the idea is that when a command is received by a smart lock, it will first receive the command, second, process the command, thirdly, send electricity to the motor to lock the lock, fourthly, update the smart lock variable to 1 to reflect the fact that our lock is now locked, and now we have a locked smart lock. Now, what happens if it by chance exactly the same request is being sent by a user, but perhaps half a second later? What happens? Well, that will get sent to the smart lock. It will go through the same steps, but because the second command was received a little bit later, well, there's a delay to these steps. And so what that might mean is that the smart lock variable is on the left-hand side, on the process on the left, is updated after the process on the right sends electricity to the motor, which means that in some cases, that additional electricity might have the effect of having a lock that's already locked now unlock. So we have two identical or similar processes that we call threads in the world of software engineering. They cannot be, they cannot have any overlap in terms of implementation or operation. And so what this happens a lot when we don't think about it, when we have these threads trying to do roughly the same thing at the same time. That's what we call a race condition. So for those hardware people out there who've never heard of race conditions before, that's it, where we have like a process being interrupted by a similar process halfway through. And it's very preventable, very, very preventable, but you need to have that coded into your software from the very, very start. So now that's another software failure, software failure mode that could be causing our smart lock to not lock. And a race condition essentially means that you ask your software engineers to make sure that only one command is processed at a time. Very simple to implement up front, incredibly hard to reverse engineer into code that's already out there. And so now we have a fault tree, which has lots of different potential root causes of failure from both software and potentially hardware at the same time. But that doesn't mean our root cause analysis is over, because the last thing you need to do is look at the corrective actions. So the corrective actions could be updating your software requirements and specifications because you missed something, like the current state variable not being stored in non-volatile memory that now needs to be updated with this corrective action. Another one could be to add a state sensor if you're early enough in design and you still got money in the budget to do so. A state sensor, a physical sensor detecting where that bolt is going to save so much software issue, so many software issues later on. So these are examples of corrective actions that will perhaps save the day. But a lot of the time we have to deal with what software engineers call mitigations. Essentially, they're not as robust or as long lasting as corrective actions, because they sort of ask you to modify how you deal with your product in the interim. And another word for these is also analogous roughly to workarounds. So mitigations could be regular resets. We ask our users to regularly take the batteries out, put the batteries in, or we have new operating procedures. Now, that's not a one that's very specific to our smart lock. It's more applicable to fielded systems, which are a little bit more user intensive, think manufacturing. Another mitigation, the only two mitigations we have. But you can see that when it comes to root cause analysis, you really want to work out which corrective actions, which mitigations are going to have the most bang for your buck. And you want to usually assign some sort of importance, some sort of likelihood, some sort of cost, ease of cost or ease of installation metric with it. And you want to prioritize them. So of course, the most important thing you need to do is update set specifications and requirements if they're not up to speed. But if they are, or even if they are problematic, then there's all sorts of different ways you can address a potential root cause of failure. But the main message here is that your root cause analysis isn't done until you implement corrective actions. And which is another way of saying we're not here to admire problems. Admiring problems is what a lot of root cause analyses end up doing. You might have a magnificent Ishikawa diagram or fault tree, but unless you implement corrective actions on not just your favorite root causes, but the entire brainstorm set, then you're going to admire problems. And the idea is that you come up with as many potential root causes of failure as possible, so you then can choose the vital few corrective actions. You don't want to do everything, but you want to do the ones that are easiest to implement and most likely to resolve this problem for as long as possible or as many units as possible. So that's one of the reasons why you often want to have a large fault tree or brainstorm a large fault tree during root cause analysis, because it gives you a huge smorgasbord of potential things to investigate and do. And perhaps a software patch can fix a hardware issue like that insulation degradation. But like I said, here is here's a QR code for the common defect enumeration. This is now redundant because Fred has had the temerity to go and research this during my webinar and put the link up in the chat window. Long story short, I've given you the opportunity to find this spreadsheet. And if you're going to do root cause analysis or for me as in the future, please use it. And now, quick plug on software for me is. Software for me is essentially use a lot of the things we talked about, but they're all about prevention. As you can imagine, the reason why this CDE exists is because these are the software failure modes that are found time and time and time and time again in the real world. There's no reason for us to keep making the same mistakes. So for example, there's no reason why you can't go through the CDE as part of a FMEA process up front and realize that your software engineers need to code software to deal with the batteries running flat, the smart lock losing power, and new batteries being put back in. There's no reason why you can't predict that being something that your software engineers need to do. And if they don't, your product will fail or your smart lock will fail. So software for me is essentially take a lot of what we talked about today and essentially package them up in an activity where you focus on prevention rather than reaction. So for example, one thing that a FMEA might get you to do is create a state diagram. This is a state diagram for our smart lock where you can see how we have worked out how our smart lock transitions from different states, locked states, unlocked states, power lost. It has triggers for each arrow. And why this is really important is because a lot of times the software engineers or software coders, they aren't as familiar with the hardware, how the users are going to interact with the product as the sort of the original designers, so to speak. We often not get software guys and girls to come in and realize our magnificent vision. Now, if you just say, just make the smart lock work, they'll try and make it work based on their understanding of the system. But to make sure that you communicate what the software needs to do as thoroughly as possible, then things like state diagrams are going to be invaluable for the software engineers, because now they know what the software code needs to do when it comes to state management. So having a state diagram up front can perhaps mitigate or perhaps eliminate all those faulty state management software failure modes we just looked at for our smart lock. And again, there's no reason why you can't do this up front. Yes, it means you need to slow down during those first few minutes of euphoric design when you're asked to come up with a brand new smart lock on day one, But if you do things like this, you save months, years, millions of dollars, whatever the right metric of value is later on. And of course, one of the things you really need to understand is how your users interact with your product or device. And if you don't do that, especially for software, then you're almost always going to have a problem later on. And so this comes down to this concept I use a lot, the quality and reliability mindset. It's software is often seen as something that which is an easy fix later on. It's not. Software can often take a lot of money and time to fix up. And just so you know, the little coding errors where someone forgets the decimal point or someone puts a multiplication sign instead of a plus sign, those are the ones that are really easy to find, really, and really easy to fix. So get them out of your mindset if you would think that we're trying to essentially stand over the shoulders of software engineers and make sure they make everything right in terms of the syntax and the decimal points and everything else. People will make those mistakes. They're really easy to find. They're really cheap to fix. The hard ones to fix are the ones where we forget that we need to have transitions from different states, or we forget to code what needs to happen when the batteries go flat, or we forget to ensure race conditions aren't allowed from the very start. And that comes down to your mindset. Okay, so on that note, are there any questions? There's a couple here, missed that. Hello from Carl. I see a couple of comments. Couple of hellos. Brian states that I find that software specifications usually don't cover all the reasonable physical failure modes, especially on complex machines. Have instituted fault trees or FMEAs to address. Some jurisdictions require similar analysis for autonomous machine operation. Fantastic. Software FMEAs, if you're concerned that specifications don't cover everything, software FMEAs, when done well, will fix that. We're talking about prevention here. So a well-run software FMEA will identify problems with specifications and requirements up front. I cannot advocate for them enough. And Patrick writes, too bad more organizations don't apply state charting in their systems design. Could not agree more. They're very simple to do, and they can save months, years, and money. I still prefer state charting like David Harrell's that has been adapted to UML and so on. Hey, I'm not advocating one style over another. If you've got a state charting format that works better for you, and yeah, you use it. In my root cause analysis course, I don't advocate, for example, for fault trees over Ishikawa diagrams, or I just say use whichever one works for you. So please don't look at my state chart and say that's the laminated version of a template of what it's supposed to look like. Use the one which works for you and your team. And if your team is trained in a particular way, you may as well exploit their understanding. Any more questions, or have I waffled on for too long? Show of hands, who has not heard of common defect enumeration in the past? No worries, Patrick. Yeah, so a good chunk of us haven't. Okay, so hands down, show of hands. Who's excited about what common defect enumeration could do for you and your future software RCA or RCA and FMEA efforts? Okay, quite a few hands coming up. Nice. Now, for CDE, for the common defect enumeration, I cannot emphasize it enough. If you want to mess it up, just get a monkey to copy and paste from the CDE to your product, to your system. I cannot encourage you enough to take the categories of software failure modes, cross to your version of the smart lock, and reword or retitle that category in words that make sense for your system. It forces you to make sure you're just not copying and pasting. And then for the software failure modes that you then explore beneath that, again, if you take them from the CDE, don't just copy and paste the words, reword them in words that make sense for your product, for your system. That will save so much time later on. It will make the brainstorming that much more efficient. It's just the best. And same with the potential root causes and corrective actions. Thanks, Brian. D'Angelo writes, are you familiar with how many of the tasks covered today are already a part of DAL processes for DO178? The short answer is, I'm not aware of how many. I'm pretty certain, though, it's not a lot. And thanks for the feedback. Just to be clear, too, again, look, I think I'm all right at software root cause analysis, but if you want to go to the oracle of software reliability, that person is Anne Marie. For example, if you look at that spreadsheet, on the right-hand side, you'll see the reference or where each one of those software failure modes and corrective actions came from, the reference for that particular idea, and you'll see Anne Marie's name line up row after row after row after row. So you can see how much effort she has put into creating that spreadsheet, which is now in the Defence Acquisition University, because that's how universally good it is. So yeah, I'm not going to pretend that I'll be able to answer a question better than she can. And for any hardware engineers who turned up today, hey, don't just cut off software and say that's somebody else's job. Just having a rudimentary understanding of how software can ruin your day, just going to the CDE and making sure your root cause analysis comes up with great ideas, you could potentially, again, save millions or years or months by using software to fix what could be a hardware problem, or making sure that your hardware doesn't trigger a software problem. I don't. No worries. Thank you. I don't think questions are coming, Fred. I think people want me to stop talking, which I respect, by the way.